part of every life, lying in wait for all of us. I've had this theory for most of my adult life. I wrote about it in Dear Dad, that all we deal with in life is loss. We just keep losing. The comfort of the womb, access to our mother's breasts, the luxury to mess our pants, we lose family members, friends, teachers, neighbors, our hair, our teeth, our speed, our flexibility, our youth. We lose them, don't get them back, and don't know how to deal with these losses because we haven't been taught how. We won't admit it, most of us anyways, how much it hurts. In many ways, often more subconscious than conscious, we spend all of our lives trying to alleviate the feeling of loss, often grasping tightly to the things that we should let go of. We should all hug each other tighter because of the presence of loss, because loss is there to remind us to live every minute fully and enjoy it, like it's the last dark chocolate buttercream caramel or dark chocolate truffle or milk chocolate pecan English walnut cluster in the box of Russell Stover's candy, just to name a few. Because I had to say something upbeat when talking about loss. The world is full of sorrow right now, but maybe always. Probably. No, definitely always. I live with sorrow every day because I see it everywhere. Last night I had a job performing for a company that transports individuals and families from one side of the globe to the other. They take you and all your stuff all the way down to your toothbrush from St. Paul, Minnesota to Dubai. Or from Paris, Texas to Paris, France, or vice versa. Or as I like to say, verse visa. Or from Boston to Austin, or Nebraska to Alaska, or Malta to Yalta. Sorry, I can't help myself. Afterward, I had a meet and greet and took about 100 photos with people. What autographs were a generation ago, Mom? That's what these celebrity photos are now. Did I just call myself a celebrity? Ugh. Did you ever get any autographs, Mom? Did you get one from Dad the first night you saw him play trumpet with Hoagie Carmichael's band and fell in love with him? I know you and your mom and your dad listen to the radio as Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic, and we were all watching the moon landing on TV together. So anyway, after the show for the movie company, I was riding high, carrying my leftovers and walking to the car that they sent for me. I remember how much you enjoyed it when they sent a car for us when I was filling in for Joan Rivers because her husband, Edgar, had committed suicide. Joan was feeling sorrow then and maybe forever after that because suicide is a brutal thing. You just don't know what to do, who to be mad at. When someone commits suicide, here's the question I always have. Who do they want to kill? I know Dad's sister killed herself because of the murder at their house years earlier, which ultimately caused Dad such agony, and his agony caused you and all your children such agony. Do you think it's smart for me not to have kids, Mom? Sorrow is like plastic in the environment. It takes years for it to dissipate. Spellcheck wants to say disappear or dissolve instead of dissipate. But I'm not going to let it, Mom. I'm not going to let spellcheck win. Sorrow is like a sparrow. Out of nowhere, it can land right in front of you. Though luckily, it can also be gone in an instant. On this beautiful Chicago evening, I was feeling no sorrow. I had a great show, people laughing and cheering me on, uplifting comments during the photo taking from "I'm a longtime fan," to "I love Life with Louie," to "I love your stuff about your parents," "I love your mom character on Baskets." At the Waldorf Astoria, Chicago, I went up to my room, had some dinner, and decided I needed a shower to relax. In hotels, I always ask for a handicapped bathroom because the showers are better to walk into. Bigger, less slippery, and the older you get, the more you need the railing. Plus, there's a chair that folds out from the wall that you can sit on. I turned the water on and just let it run over me. I was really enjoying my shower. There's something about a really nice hot shower that brings you anywhere you want to go. It gives you a chance to wipe away some of what's racing through your mind after a show. An entertainer's quick path to meditation. I got the show. I got the laughs. I got the check. I got to meet lots of wonderful people. I knew I was a lucky guy. Then a creak and a crash. Before I knew it, I had pulled the chair out of the wall and was lying on the shower floor. I rolled over, half laughing, half crying. The water continued to run over me. I was very afraid I might not be able to get up. Here I was, an entry on Comedy Central's list of 100 greatest stand-ups of all time. 420 pounds, and I couldn't even stand up. I was lying on the shower floor, the entire seat pulled out of the shower wall. My first instinct was to blame someone. But who? There must have been a warning on the chair, but I couldn't see one. What was the top weight the chair was good for? 300, 350, 450? As the numbers climbed in my head, I realized in that moment what I had thought I'd realized so many, many times before. I have to do something about this. I felt a range of emotions, embarrassment, shame, fear, rage, self-loathing, but really sorrow. How did this happen? How do you get like this? This was definitely my next journey, I thought, while lying there, water pounding on my body. This time I'll complete it. Sometimes you just know when you're going to do a good job, cutting the lawn, washing the car, cleaning the fridge, writing a book report. You just know. It was time. I felt it. Humiliation and desperation are powerful motivators. A lot of people are going to say to me, "You look really good, but aren't you worried you won't be funny?" When I hear that, my answer will be very simple. "No, I'm not worried at all," I'll say. I got up off the floor. I don't even remember how, though I believe I reached for a towel and grabbed the handle of the shower and somehow got my footing. As much as anything, I willed myself up. And when I stood, I took a good long look at myself in the mirror. I said goodbye to that body. I said hello to my new life. I walked into the bedroom, picked up the bag of M&Ms that I'd taken from the minibar and tossed on the bed, waiting to be devoured, and returned them to the minibar. No more M&Ms for me. I told myself I was going to try and live on really healthy food, lots of laughs, love, gratitude, and humility. "I'm going to do whatever I have to do, Mom. Love, Soaking Wet Louie." Twelve-step. "Hey, Mom, I'm back in a 12-step program. I rejoined last week, on April 15th, after a friend said to me, 'Hey, Louie, are you going to just freaking kill yourself? Because if you're going to just freaking kill yourself, I don't really want to be around to watch. And if you don't give a damn about you, I'm not going to give a damn about you.'" I woke up. I mean, it's not the first wake-up call I've had in my life. And I think we all have a lot more wake-up calls than we recognize or are willing to acknowledge. But my friend's words were pretty harsh and totally on the money. You hate it when people say things to you like what he said to me, especially if it's a person who cares about you, but it stuck. I have to look at where I am. I want to be around for a while. I want to be the best Louie I can be. I'm exercising more. I do stuff for my chest, my back, both arms, both legs, both stomachs. 3 or 4 times a week, 3 or 4 sets for each body part. For a while, I've had a lifetime membership to Anytime Fitness because I did some commercials for them, and when I'm in there, sometimes I work with a trainer. When I'm on the road, I have this Wii Gym equipment, this little thing that you pull. I lay it out on the counter of my hotel room and pretend I'm going to use it. Sometimes I keep the door open with it. Sometimes I actually use it. This time, I hope I keep my commitment to the program. I really, really want to. I'm not going to lie, it's going to get bumpy. Like now, when I'm at a hotel and there's a stocked minibar and I want to eat all the food in front of me. Let's see, there's a giant bag of potato chips, gummy bears, peanuts, those damn M&Ms, cashews, 3 different types of cookies. And that's just what I can see from across the room. That's just the stuff speaking to me. I really am noticing it now. They would be easy pickings, these goodies, and not one of them can do me any good. Not one of them can help me. Maybe the cashews, but they're probably processed in some way. So I have to make that choice. If I wasn't on the program, and in the right space, my mind would bring me back to these all night long. Yeah, I could rationalize having the healthiest item, the cashews, but that's not in my program. Is this room service? Can I get some carrots and some celery and a side of disappointment? Mom, I hope this is some kind of turning point, and I need to share it with you. I mostly wanted you to know that I'm eating healthier, trying to avoid fast food and processed food, and trying to manage what I consume. I build in snacks and make them healthy snacks, like an apple. I'm in a better state of mind, though I know it's a day-to-day thing. I honestly don't feel threatened by the hotel candies and cookies, though I might just ask them to remove it all tomorrow, for safety's sake. Love, Louie. Fellowship. Hey, Mom. I'm on my way home from a meeting of my fellowship group, where all of us have one problem in common, food. For me and you, Mom, it was food. For Dad, it was drinking. I like bread way more than I like booze. Yet both are made from grains, and both can kill. Are grains killing all of us? Are they the most acceptable drug of choice for us Americans? It's the grain drain. I remember when Dad went to an AA meeting, and the hopeful feeling as I considered, is it really possible that I could have a nicer, more understanding, loving father? Some of us also went to an Al-Anon meeting, not Dad though, for the loved ones of alcoholics, because when someone is an alcoholic, everyone around is affected. I mean, infected. I love that Al-Anon meeting in particular. And I think you liked it, Mom. It made me feel like I wasn't the only one with a drunk for a father. Dad went to the grand total of one AA meeting. I don't need any freaking help to quit drinking, he said. I don't know that he used the word freaking. To his credit, though he never went to another meeting, he quit drinking. He never drank again after that. Problem was, he totally white-knuckled it. To Dad's discredit, his behavior didn't change much. Yeah, he wasn't as mean, especially to you, Mom, but he discovered new kinds of mean, new kinds of cruel. He was arbitrary about tasks we kids had to perform. There was no way he would be satisfied with the result, no matter how good and painstaking. If you cut the grass up and back, he'd say he wanted it cut in circles. Make him a sandwich, and guaranteed you put the meat and the cheese in the wrong order. One day he liked mustard, the next day he didn't. And all of his demands accompanied by, what are you, fricky moron? I don't know that he used the word fricking. We never went to another Al-Anon meeting, even though I liked the first one. That was more than 45 years ago, those initial meetings. I'm glad I'm going to these fellowship meetings now. I go at least once a week. It makes me feel less alone. I'm living a healthier life. I'm healing a giant part of me. Just sorry it took so many years to really take care of myself. But better late than never, right, Mom? What failed with Dad maybe won't fail with me. Your healthier and happier son, Louie. It's your fault, Mom. Hey, Mom, you're the loveliest person I ever knew, and I was so fortunate that it was you I had for a mother. But it wouldn't be right if I didn't point out at least a couple of your faults. Okay with you, Mom? You enabled a lot of Dad's behavior. Yes, I understand what a difficult situation you were put in, with 11 kids and being poor, and the times being what they were. But you were an enabler. When Dad quit drinking at 69, you said, I told you he'd quit. I was speechless when I heard that. I didn't say anything to you at the time. I was 17 years old, and I remember I just walked into my room and sat on my bed and said to myself, or maybe I even mumbled it out loud, oh my God, she thinks she got him to quit drinking at 69. You sometimes said to me and the other kids, it'll get better, about Dad and our situation. And you knew it was a lie. But you told yourself it was true. You told us it was, and we could see through it. I understand that Dad lived in denial much of the time, like when he got diagnosed with prostate cancer and refused to get it treated, and simply never confronted his innermost fears, at least in a constructive way that would have benefited his family and him. I tried to go a very different route, but I'm not sure you weren't more like him than me. We were poorer than you wanted to admit, Mom. And sometimes it seemed like you only wanted to talk about the kids who were doing well. You had a vain streak, not that it bothered me very much, and I've incorporated into Christine's character. And I think vanity is sometimes over-criticized, because it's really a cry for dignity and respect. Maybe because self-respect is lacking. But you did have your vain moments, don't we all? Louis, how old do you think I look? I'd always guessed under because I knew, Mom, that that's what you were fishing for. I started doing it myself, asking people to guess how old I looked, but quit when somebody got it right. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the vainest of them all? Maybe both of us, Mom. Yeah, everyone's at least a little vain, and if they're not, I don't trust them. More than once, Mom, you actually said, be a good child, Louis. Don't cause problems. Don't act up. We don't want your father to start drinking. If you'll pardon my French, Mom, what bullshit. One part of you that I've thoroughly incorporated into Christine's passive aggressiveness. No one does it with more genius than a middle American middle-aged woman. That way of sliding something in that's really pure competitiveness and often vindictiveness and a kind of showing off, but it's supposed to look nothing like it. Is anything more passive-aggressive and middle American than the expression, well, isn't that something? In my act, I used to say that Midwesterners will cut you with a razor and then say, oh my word, let me get my first aid kit. I don't know what got into me. My theory? It's so cold. We stay in the house too long. And then you live by a code that's always left me puzzled. Maybe enough to make me want to write a whole book to figure it out, while also celebrating how much I love you. That code? Everyone should tell the truth as long as it doesn't hurt people's feelings. Is that even possible, Mom? I used to blame you, Mom. Why did you put me, us, through this horrible time with our father? Why wouldn't you protect us? Why wouldn't you call the National Guard, the militia, the police? I used to blame you. Why didn't you do that, Mom? What were you thinking? What kind of mother would do that to her children? But that was a younger Louis, less empathetic Louis, a less life-experienced Louis, a Louis who had experienced less loss, less disappointment, less success. Once I started looking at myself, I understood. It came into greater focus just how hard it must have been for you. I bet you agonized over it all, internalized it enough to cause 11 ulcers in one stomach. I wonder if the sleeve operation helped you get rid of ulcers. You took the blows for us. You stood in front of the firing squad every day for us. I hope you won't be angry for me pointing out a few flaws. We all have them. Most of us, way more than you. It only makes you more human and lovable, really. With apologies, Louis. Writers need deadlines. Hey, reader. I started writing these simple letters to my mom, and then I sent them to a few friends, and they seemed to really enjoy them and said I should write a book of them. Which you'll remember I was sort of thinking about, but not with great seriousness. So I said, okay, because okay didn't mean I had to do it. Okay is about as noncommittal as you can get. We'll see is the king of noncommittal, but okay is close. Then I sent a few letters to a few publishers, and each of them I met with wanted the book, which was a good feeling and a bad feeling, because it meant that they liked it, and it also meant that I had to finish it. And if you commit to writing 65,000 words, Then you've got to write all 65,000 words down. And get this, they've got to be in the right order and make sense. So I went from being anxious if anybody would even want to read these letters to anxious about producing them and finishing them. And even more anxious as the days went by, because I now have to have this book done by November 1st, and it's already October. I have my phone on mute a lot these days. Anyway, if I didn't have a deadline, I probably wouldn't finish it. So, fortunately, I have one. I think deadlines are started by moms and dads. They're soft deadlines, maybe more for moms. Clean your room, honey, because I don't want to keep walking by here and seeing this mess. And not-so-soft ones, maybe more from dads. You're not leaving the house until you finish mowing the lawn. How am I going to mow the lawn if I can't leave the house? There are office deadlines. I'd like to have this report done by Friday, Louie. I'm sure you would, and I'd like to have an ice cream Sunday, but there's no ice cream, and it's not Sunday. That's good, Louie. Just get me the report by Friday. And there's show business deadlines. We have to finish shooting this scene by 4:30, drop dead latest. Why? That's when the sun starts setting. But the scene takes place in the basement. It's just a basement. There's no house there. We need deadlines. I'm glad I have a deadline to finish the book. I have a question for you, the listener. Not my mom, but you. When are you going to contact, surprise, or hug the people you love? That's my deadline for everyone. Just like I should have been a lot nicer, more loving to my mom, and I should have done more for her. And then she was gone. Here's my deadline for whoever's out there. Call your mom. Call your dad. Call your sister. Call your brother. Call your son. Call your daughter. Make plans for dinner with them. Go to lunch with them. It could be breakfast, if that's your preference. Give them some of the time they've given you. Sometimes even give them the time they haven't given you. Don't be one of those people who starts weeping with regret every time they hear Harry Chapin's Cats in the Cradle or Fiddler on the Roof's Sunrise, Sunset. I mean, if you're over 40, you'll weep anyway. But don't be one of those people who weep so hard that everyone within 50 yards starts getting uncomfortable. You won't regret taking the time now rather than later. It's impossible to regret that. But if you don't do it now, when you can, you will regret it later, when you can't. Trust me on that. One more thing I know for sure. Only a very small group of people are truly taking in what I just said. I hope you are in that group. I was once one of those not in the group, and I didn't listen until I was absolutely forced to. And in some ways, it was too late. I can't discuss this with you anymore. Got to get back to work. 65,000 words is a lot of words. But thanks for letting me spill about 700 more of them right here. Love you, whoever you are. Sirius Lewis on Deadline. This book is not about you, Dad, except when it is. Hey, Mom. Today I got to see the 10 scripts for season 3 of Baskets, and there's a scene in episode 3 taken exactly from our life. Last year I told this story to Jonathan, the director, and the season 3 writers, and they decided it was perfect to incorporate. Instead of happening to me, which it did, now it happens to young Christine Baskets in a flashback. So, remember the time when Dad got so drunk? I know, which time, right? Then insisted on driving back through the snow with Tommy and me in the car, and I pleaded with him not to do it, but he wouldn't listen. And then, as he was nodding off, he accidentally floored the gas, and the car shot through the wooded area in front of our house, where we used to pick raspberries in the summer and slide down the snow in the winter. And now branches were being hacked off as the car plowed through the snowy woods until we crashed into a tree. And Dad just snored through it all. And I had to go get help from home before Dad and Tommy froze. I got out of the car and scampered up the hill, but it was very icy and I slid down. I tried again and I slid down. And the third time I went up and I knew I was going to slide down, and I just went with it.
Whee!
And almost forgot that Dad had just driven us into a tree and almost killed Tommy and me. Yeah, that time. Anyway, there's a scene like that now in the show where young Christine is pleading with her alcoholic father not to drive. But he does, because that's what drunks do. And she's in the car with him, and they plow into the hospital. And she has to take charge to get help. Fact and fiction. My own explanations of my childhood. What's fact and what's fiction? Dad was a veteran. That's fact. Doesn't matter whose point of view. It's fact. World War I bugler. But how much that fact affected his behavior and how much he still controlled, that's no fact anymore. Or maybe there's more than one set of facts. No, forget that, Mom. I don't want to put it that way. Sounds too much like fake news. Mom, I won't even bother explaining that to you this time around. Dad was funny, but I don't think I can call that a fact because it was almost always mean funny, which is not everybody's cup of tea.
Louie, you got a point there. Too bad it's at the top of your head.
Or, I think you're really a great person, so far. Funny, yes, but mean funny. And when he maintained sobriety for the last decade of his life, it's a fact that he didn't take another drink. Okay, that's technically not true. There was this one time in the casino when he was so sick with cancer and he was playing the dime slot machine and they came around offering free drinks and he ordered a cold beer and I kept my mouth shut, though I was upset. But is it a fact that we were better off this way? From whose perspective? In many ways, he was just as cruel, only in a different way. He was innovating new ways to be an a-hole. As kids, Dad and his sister were taken away from their parents after a murder occurred in their home during a party, with the parents nowhere to be found. Dad and Olga were put up in front of the local church. That's the root of the phrase, put up for adoption. They were chosen by separate families and split up forever. Dad's new family basically wanted an unpaid farmhand. They made him live in the attic. In some important ways, he was a better person than either of his reckless parents. But what do I do with these facts, or fictions? Do I forgive him? Yes, I forgive him. Do I think I understand him? In some ways, yes, in some ways, never. Is it better, Mom, that you didn't leave him, didn't divorce him, didn't get on with your life and our 11 lives? Only you can answer that. For years and years, I told myself that I understood why you didn't. It was the times and we were poor, and there were just so many mouths to feed. And this is not a small thing. You still loved him, in a way you always adored him. But I didn't get the nurturing or quality encouragement that a kid needs from a dad, that a son needs from his dad. I did get to be in his sunlight, though. And even sunlight that doesn't always shine bright is better than no sunlight at all. Would I be as funny as I am and successful as I am and be doing the thing that I absolutely love doing if I hadn't been exposed to him and the relentlessness of his cruelty to us? I doubt it. If he hadn't treated me like that, would I have searched so long and hard to find something to explain it all or something to make me feel better? Maybe that's what makes the comedy. Your stick of butter, Mom, plus his gallon of vinegar. Should I cut him some slack simply because he was also the kind of guy who would get into a big fight with someone, then go buy groceries and leave them on the doorstep of someone else who was struggling worse than we were? I don't know, Mom. He was the good, the bad, and the ugly all rolled up into one. Maybe that's who all of us are, only in different measures. I know I can't get him out of my head either, and writing a book about him didn't change things completely. Like I could put all that to rest. Just this week, I met with the producers from the Strand Theater in San Francisco, and they offered me the chance to workshop Dear Dad and help me take it from the page to the stage. Crazily, I said yes. And I have this idea where at each performance, we ask a few theatergoers to be part of the show by each reading one of the letters I wrote to him in that book. And in the lobby would be a display of the letters and all those photographs from Dad's life, and when he was a younger man, and a trumpet player in Hoagy Carmichael's band, and things seemed a little brighter for him, or maybe not, given what his childhood was like. And there'd be a trumpet player playing me off and on stage, and during crucial scenes, too. A trumpet blaring while I'm reading about being tortured by my father. If things go well, maybe that journey will end up taking me and Dad and you and the rest of our family to Broadway. I know this, Mom. When the book came out, I did a bunch of interviews promoting it, and one of the interviewers asked me, Louis, would you trade all that happened then and since for a normal childhood? And to that question, then and now, I always say, yes. Simple. I've already had the unhappy childhood. Why not give the happy one a go? Sorry, though I don't think I need to apologize. Louis. Reunion. Hey, Mom. I just returned from our Anderson family reunion. What a beautiful day. Jimmy and Janice set it up. We had it at Keller Park. And because it rained most of the day, it was a good thing we were under one of those pavilions. It was a great setup. Jimmy and Janice had it catered, and then everybody put in some money to help. Jimmy and Janice had this great way of putting all this together, and we had a great turnout. It always makes me happy to see everyone. We had a photographer come and take pictures, and then my friend took a video of the whole thing, so there's an archive of it. I love that. Mom, you and Dad spawned more than half of the nearly 100 in the family, though there were closer to 80 at the gathering. Starting with the next generation, by last count, it was 27 nieces and nephews, 22 great-nieces and great-nephews, 10 great-great-nieces and great-great-nephews. It was so cool to see different versions of your face or Dad's face in so many of these young people. Oh, God, he looks just like Mom when he laughs. Or, wow, she has the same gait as Kent does. Oh, that's a spitting image of Sheila. He's got the same complexion as Dad. That sort of thing. And all of them, or anyway, all but those who married into the family, carry the tradition of being good, bad, and indifferent Andersons. And always interesting Andersons. And maybe some of those who married in, too. I sometimes say I'm 20% Norwegian, 80% butter, that we're from the Land O'Lakes tribe. But this is who I am, Mom. These are our people. You'd be really proud. Several of the kids are in college, and one of your descendants is starting medical school, and so many others have turned out to be quite something. The sky's the limit. Every generation seems to be getting healthier and better, and gatherings like these are really important so that we can all know each other, connect with each other, and love each other. It was truly a wonderful day, like I said. It rained for most of it, but the skies cleared up later, and Jimmy Sr. renewed his vows with his sweetheart Leela, whom he met in his 70s. Can you believe it, Mom? I was the best man. Jimmy's son David married them. He got ordained just so he could do that. A really lovely exclamation point to a lovely event. And I'm so glad to see Jimmy so happy, and Leela so happy. She's been good to the boys. You'd be thrilled by it all, Mom. Proud as punch, as a Minnesota icon, Hubert Humphrey, used to say. And, Mom, one of the babies in the family is named Orizella. You did it. You're still alive. So there's a baby with your name. And a son who plays you every Tuesday night on FX. Mom, are you having a partial family reunion? Tell everyone we miss them, and I hope Dad is straightened out, and everybody is happy and loving and caring up there. I want to believe there's lots of good things to come. There was lots of hugging and kissing at our reunion, Mom. Lots of love. Louis, just one of the many descendants of Aura, Zella Anderson. Season 3. Hey, Mom. The cast and directors and writers all did a table read of Season 3 of Baskets at Zach's house. It was a wonderful experience. We had pizza brought in for the gang. Me, I had lots of salad. A year ago, it would have bothered me not to have any pizza. I would have been thinking about it the whole time we were reading each of the 10 scripts, but it's okay now. Writing on these letters to you has made me realize something. Life is finite.
Duh.
Time is valuable, ditto. And so am I. I'm valuable. I'm starting to treat myself as if I'm valuable. I don't get the potato chips. I go right for the celery, the carrots, the cucumbers, the cauliflower. Our favorite vegetable, Mom. Who doesn't love cauliflower? I'm in a different frame. I love vegetables once I get going with them. I don't graze. I don't get the sloppy joe. I don't get the donut, Mom. I've lost count of how many hundreds, maybe thousands of donuts I've passed up from the baskets craft service set up. Though for historical purposes, let me tell you, they had cronuts the other day. And I know you would love a cronut. A flaky donut that didn't exist when you were alive, but thanks to breakthroughs in pastry research, brought together the croissant and the donut to make the cronut. I'm figuring out a way to heal, to work the steps, as we say in the program. I reach out to others for help when I need it. I'm back in Los Angeles for the next 3 months. I heard from the producer that they made a wig for season 3 that cost $9,000. Can you believe it? $9,000? And it's not like we're a big budget show. Why so expensive? They hand tie every single hair individually to the mesh shell that has thousands of tiny holes. Supposedly, it will look more like my hair than my hair does. I can't wait to see it. Christine is moving up in the world. I found this little apartment in Studio City in the Valley because I know we're going to be doing a lot of shooting in the Valley. You remember Studio City, Mom? I'm pretty sure you were there with me once. I should have taken you to a lot more places. I should have done a lot more nice things for you. I'm so sorry I wasn't a better son, but I'm trying not to play that song over and over. Love, Louie. The Sorrow Sparrow. Hey, Mom. Am I a sorrow sponge? I leave myself wide open. I was heading out of town for a gig in Chicago, and I saw this young woman at the airport gate who weighed well over 300 pounds. She was short, too, and all I wanted to do was wrap my arms around her. Just wanted to hold her because I knew how much pain she was probably in. She was in her 20s, a young woman with beautiful purple braids. I told her I loved her hair. The flight was delayed. In the old days, a flight delay would have made me all, damn this and screw that. Instead, we talked. Mia was her name. She seemed nervous about flying. She was in phone sales. At one point, I went to the newsstand to buy some bottled water and see if they had anything healthy to snack on. And I asked Mia if I could get her something. Not too pushy, though. And she shook her head sweetly, sadly. Thank you, no. While I was at the newsstand, I looked back and saw that she was drinking some sugary-type drink and sneaking a bite of an Almond Joy while scrolling through her phone. I imagined myself returning from the errand and going right up to her and reading her the riot act, asking her if she would go to my 12-step meeting with me. But when I returned, I said nothing. I gave her a big hug when she boarded the plane. After we landed at O'Hare, I saw her again. There you are, I said. You made it. I thought of asking if we could take a picture. Mia, I've always loved that name. You know why? Because I'm always thinking of Mia. It made her laugh. I thought about asking her to exchange emails, thinking maybe I could be helpful to her, but it seemed too forward. I should have. This is my new life. Maybe I've always been this way, but now I'm trying to be more proactive about it. Ours is the burden of food, and for all my struggles, I thought I could help her find her way out. She was probably suffering beyond belief, and no one really knows what to do about it. It moved me to meet and talk with Mia. I don't think I'm seeing these people by chance. I don't know what anyone or anything is telling me, full moons or fat hummingbirds or colors swirling in the bathroom light, or you, Mom, now almost literally guiding me every time I dress up as Christine. But I feel there is some reason for all this. Anyway, Mom, you would do the same. Compliment someone on their hair, what a nice dress she was wearing, what a pretty smile she had, and then just make friends with her. Were you just getting to know them, Mom, or did you see something in them that you needed? Or see something in yourself that you thought they needed? Regardless, it's who we are, Mom. We can't control it. We're suckers for people. There's nothing we can do about it. We're people pleasers. There isn't anything else, really. That's why everyone watches TV and movies. Whether the story is real or make-believe, we're all interested in seeing what happens to people. Because we're all trying to figure ourselves out. What a cruel world we live in, that someone has to be 300 or 400 pounds. That's the drug of this generation. I always see the bigger people in a way that many others don't. Some people don't have easy lives. They just don't. I think a lot of women are sad. Men too, of course. But I see sad women out there, mostly because I'm playing Christine. I watch Mia walk away in the direction of the baggage claim. Walk slowly, but still more spryly than I walk now, because she still has youth on her side. The sorrow sparrow landed on my shoulder, Mom. Here's my goal with Christine. A lot of people know a Christine. A lot of people are Christine. Mom, let me share an email a viewer sent me this morning. Good morning, Mr. Anderson. I'm writing to thank you for all you do. You've always made me laugh. I really needed it. When I was going through a hard time, your character on Baskets, a.k.a. Christine, lifted my spirits. Somehow you channeled my mom, which really made me happy, because she's not with me anymore, which I needed. I love that, a.k.a. I get stuff like this every day. Posts on Facebook, tweets, messages on Instagram, emails. Some of it is devastating. Some of it is inspiring. Often, I can't separate the two. I really want to help people, Mom. I want to be nicer to everybody. Not just when they have sorrow, though sorrow is always lurking, always. That's what you were all about, being kind all the time, no matter what. There's a chain reaction of being kind. People showed up at your funeral that none of us knew about. Or they said they'd met you only once. And they just wanted to be there for you. For themselves. A few years ago when I went on the TV show Splash and faced my fear of heights, I think it gave some others strength. Not think, I know, because lots of people came up to me in the months after my episode aired and told me things like, I learned how to swim because of you. I started to swim again because of you. I started to face some of my fears. Thank you so much, Louie. I try my best always to put myself in everyone's position, Mom. At the hotel, a room service gentleman lugs a cart full of orders, doing his best to get everyone's right. This one wants to have his coffee with this kind of cream. That one says, can you make sure I get a spoon I like? Is there a fork in there? Can you make sure the food comes up hot? Can you make sure the ice isn't melted? You call this an entree? This is really all the damn shrimp in the shrimp cocktail? Suppose I'm the 12th person he's dealt with today, Mom.
Has he had an easy time of it? Are those carts easy to move around?
How can they be, with the hotel carpet that thick?
He just wants to get in and out of each room and each encounter, do his job right, and move on to the next. You can't blame room service people. They enter your room like maybe they've been jumped or attacked before. So I put myself in his place. Hey, how is your day going? Are you busy down there? Is anyone giving you a bad time? Tell me, I'll go down there and talk to them about it. Why not put myself in the position of empathizing and understanding, since I could so easily be in that position? It could be me who's delivering the food and, frankly, wants to eat some of it on the way up. Does the guest in room 1405 really know he's supposed to get 4 little muffins with his breakfast, not 3? The maid comes in to make up the bed. And I actually want to make my own bed, because since I started with the 12-step program, I've been making my own bed. I decided to stop asking people to wait on me and start taking care of myself, because if I don't, then I'll have lower expectations of myself. So I asked the maid, how's your morning going? She's taken back. She smiles. We talk.
She has a daughter applying for law school. I tell the maid, I don't need anything, not even the bed maid. No, not even, she says. She looks alarmed. I assured her it's okay. She asks if she can punch in a code into the room phone to show her boss that she's been to the room. Punch away, I say, giddy. Get that code in there. I asked her for the code so I could punch it in every day, so she could just skip my room. She just smiled. You aren't what you eat. You aren't what you say. You are what you do. I feel like right now I'm the best Louis I can be. I can even get better. Good night, Mom. I don't feel sorrow right now. Love, Louis. Defending Champ. Hey, Mom. In my heart, I think I can win it again. Everyone already has Alec Baldwin winning this year's Emmy for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series. And the Donald Trump impersonation he does on Saturday Night Live is great, really. Remember what you used to say about Donald Trump, Mom? He's president of the United States now. Alec gets the water cooler buzz because his appearances are commentaries on what happened in politics this week, even within the previous day or two. Since Hollywood is not happy with Donald Trump, the Emmy voters might want to say something with their choice. We'll see. Every Academy voter is supposed to watch one episode of each of the nominees. In my category, that's Alec Baldwin, Titus Burgess again on Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Ty Burrell again on Modern Family, Tony Hale and Matt Walsh again on Veep, and me. All of them are truly outstanding. That sounds like I'm already giving my acceptance speech. We submitted the Denver episode to show my work as Christine. I think it's a great episode. Some really beautiful work with Alex Morris as Ken. After discussing with her mother the idea of meeting someone to date, Christine decides to take a chance and overcome her fear of rejection so that she doesn't end up alone and she can live a little, maybe even twirl a little. Even if I don't win, I'm content with what I'm doing. I know I'm just playing who this woman is. And I have to reflect on how glad I am just to be working. Amos, my manager, will accompany me this afternoon to the Emmys. You only get 2 tickets. I wish I could take you, Mom. If you were here, you'd sit next to me, and we'd have to buy a 3rd ticket for Amos for $700. I'll probably also sit near Zach, who was nominated this year for Outstanding Lead Actor, which he deserved. He really deserves 2 nominations since he plays Dale Baskets and Chip Baskets. I told him last year that he'd get a nomination this time. He often plays a funny person, but there's such depth to his characters and such breadth to his talent. He never telegraphs what he's going to do. His unbelievable work in season 2 made me work harder and strive to do more. Jonathan should have got a nomination for director, which he so deeply deserves. Anyway, Mom, wish me luck again. Love, Louis. The Day You Died. Hey, Mom. It's a letter I've been thinking about and dreading since I started writing you letters a couple years ago. Maybe you've been dreading it, too, mostly because you feel my pain. This is the worst, hardest letter I will write. But we often have to do things we hate, right? So I need to do this. I thought you were going to live forever. The day a mom dies is the day her child's life changes forever. It's the first time you really, truly feel mortality, because the person who brought you into the world is no longer there. You are forced to confront the idea that you might actually be mortal because up until then you thought you were invincible. You were so very powerful because the person who brought you into the world was there with you, and you were both alive. In your existence, you had both always been alive. But then she dies, and something in you dies. So I guess that means I could die, you think? When she dies, part of your heart stops beating. Something loosens in you, something that gave you stability and comfort. And now you're no longer secure on the stage of life. Now you realize that things could come crashing down around you. When the person who brought you into the world, who wiped your chin and wiped your butt, who was there for you and protected you and shaped you, who gave you an identity when you didn't have one. When you lose that lifeline, it's like the movie Gravity. And now, you're floating in space and hoping to hell that someone will catch you or that you can grab a line so that you can tether yourself to it. It's the very first day you feel that maybe you could die. January 4th, 1990. I was in Minneapolis. I'd performed on New Year's Eve and decided to stay over for a few days, down at the old flour mill that became a hotel, which meant the rooms were a little smaller, the hallways a little darker, the windows a little weirder than a hotel built as a hotel. But I was comfortable in my room and fell asleep early. I woke up to a ringing telephone, ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing. I didn't know if it was a real phone ringing or a dream of a phone ringing. I did not know where I was. You know I sleep on my side, Mom, and the phone was behind me, and I did not want to turn over and face whatever it was, whoever it was, whatever reason it was ringing and ringing. Yet even as I tried to ignore it, I was becoming more and more awake, and I looked toward the door, and there you were. Only it was a much bigger version of you, practically a giant figure of you, with what seemed like thousands of beams of light coming out of you, with a thousand scarves flowing and blowing around the room, but scarves that are completely transparent, more like wisps of light than a solid material. Some of the colors I'd never seen before, so I can't even describe them. It made me smile and feel love. I reached my hand toward some of the scarves and the colors that were nearest, but it felt as if something was touching me, as if I was being reached out to, a way of communicating, but I didn't know what. I felt a tug, and it was the back and forth between whatever was going on between us. And then, the horrible hotel phone ringing, the explosive, awful clanging punctuated by brief silences. I rolled over to face the phone, and the ringing dimmed. I looked back toward the door and marveled even more at this beautiful vision before me. A real you-had-to-be-there moment. A sight I have tried to describe here, but I know my description does not suffice. Finally, I put the phone to my ear, and all the light, all the color, all the hope rushed out, as if a vacuum from out in the hallway sucked everything inside my room underneath the door. I was in the dark again. Louie, Louie. A familiar voice. Anderson, brother, third. Yeah, I must have said automatically. It's Jimmy. Mom died. I don't know how long it was before I simply said, shit. There was another pause by me, for how long I don't know. Finally, with a sense of purpose, I said, hold on a minute, Jimmy. I put down the phone, stood, walked to the door, opened it, and looked down the hallway. I was looking for that vision, that light, that love, that hope that had just been present in the room, now realizing that you've been saying your final earthly goodbye. There was no sign of you. Yet the hallway was brighter than it was before, I swear. You'd left something behind, maybe a message, a little hope, assurance that you had been there, that you took time before you ascended to give me a last loving Orizella Anderson hug. When I picked up the phone again, Jimmy told me the details. You were in your car and it stalled. Mom used to snap your fingers and say, when I die, I want to go like that. Well, you died in your car. Fortunately, the car wasn't moving when you had your massive heart attack. It was over as quick as a snap of your fingers. It's a long life, but not as long as I wished. Maybe every kid says that, no matter when their mom goes. You outlived Dad, Mom, by 10 years. He was also 12 years older than you, so your lifespans were almost the same. When your mom dies, you realize that you, too, will one day die. It finally really hits home. But in thinking about these really sad things, you eventually realize something else. You're here. Thinking about these things, you're still here. So that must mean when things come crashing down around you, you can still get up. You can rise from the ashes, climb out of the destruction. You can still make something happen, something good. It's possible. Just like I knew how much I did not want to write this letter and hated the idea of writing this letter, here I am, writing this letter. When Mom dies, you dread doing anything new, anything more, anything else. But you have to. You have to right the ship. You have to right things that are wrong as best you can. You find strength you didn't know you had. I guess I'm glad this letter is over. Love, your thankful child, Louie. To everyone who is a mom or had a mom. Hey, Mom, and all the other moms and dads. So that's about all I have to say. I think I've said a lot. Oh, yeah, I didn't win the second Emmy. Alec Baldwin, the betting favorite, nabbed it. That's politics for you. No, he really was very good, really. I'm glad I took the time to talk to you and send all of my feelings and love to you. I have messages for all the other mothers and fathers out there. Thank you for just being there. God bless you all. That's the first message. Here's the second one. Keep doing what you do best. Keep loving us. Keep looking after us. But don't stop there, no. Pick a day where all the mothers and fathers of the world, from end to end, every single one of you, at the same time, walk out the front door of your house, your hovel, your hacienda, your palace, your mud hut, your cottage, your apartment, your yurt, your trailer, your igloo, your houseboat, your room, your tent tethered to the fence on Skid Row. Step outside, all of you. And then, each of you, make sure that all your sons and daughters are within earshot. Better yet, have them within arm's reach. Now take the hand of each of your children and all the mothers and fathers together, say this. Let's change the world, because it isn't working the way it is. Can we all start with a little more kindness, please? For the first 36 years of my life, I watched my mother's genius for kindness. Her talent for making family and friends feel close, and strangers just as close. Her ability to be charitable, tactful, loving, and non-judgmental. I've used these as guiding virtues for Christine Baskets. Nothing is easy when it comes to people changing. But moms have lots of power, dads too. You are the architects of love. Our first teachers, preachers, cheerleaders, the ones who've seen us at our best and our worst, who know us through and through. And you are going to save the world, moms and dads, by getting the ones you love and who love you to be a little different from those who came before. Moms and dads have a special power, tremendous, and in some ways, not close to fully tapped. What if we said we're all going to do it for the moms and the dads? Because it isn't working the way it is. If saying things gently doesn't make an impact, parents, then try this. Hey, everybody, knock it off! Stop treating each other so badly. I expect more from you. I expect you, my son, my daughter, to stop and look around and realize that we are all connected. We're all alike. We're all living on the earth together. And we're not going back into the house for coffee and cake until you truly acknowledge that. We screwed up terribly, but we're never going to stop expecting better from you. We're not going to accept less, because if we do, the world's over. It's the end of the world as we know it. For thousands of years, humankind has not gotten it right. So, get your act together. Be the first act that's really gotten it together. Love more, hate less. Do for others. Make the right decision, which you usually know what it is. Be the person you really can be, because we know you have it in you, and we can't go on like this. Wake up, smell the roses, do something for somebody, love somebody, care for somebody, change direction. If you change your desires, you have to replace them with something. And it should be something that'll be helpful to other people, to this world, to this earth, to the universe. I'm your mom or dad. Honor me as I've honored you. If you can't do it for yourself, do it for me. Hey, Mom, I want you to know that I'm taking better care of myself. I wish everyone would take better care of themselves.